Shattering Mess. I am your host and tour guide, Yada. Each weekday morning here on the Genesis Communication Network, we strive to expose the beguiling and the destructive myths that are associated with religion and politics, with patriotism in the media, and with military and economic schemes. If you listen, your eyes may be opened, and you may ultimately change your mind towards some of these human institutions. Instead of merely presenting the news, my mission will be to help you understand what is occurring behind the headlines, all while presenting how these events will shape our world over the next 10 to 20 years. Then during our second hour, we're going to engage God on His terms by way of His one and only covenant and through His always dependable Torah teaching, so that with His guidance, you'll be able to replace your religion with reason and engage in a relationship with Him. Today we will resume our presentation of matzah. Today is Passover. We have covered in great detail the meaning and purpose of Passover, and we will continue to examine the meaning and purpose of matzah, unleavened bread, today. Our phone number for those who would like to question, criticize, or affirm anything that is said over the next 2 hours is 877-300-7645. Last week, I noticed that the largest Dutch news source, Dagelijkse Standard, published an article that was by an anti-Semitism expert. It's amazing that there are experts that are devoted to a singular aspect of human nature, but indeed there is. There's an Israeli anti-Semitism expert, got a PhD in the subject. His name is Manfred Gerstenfeld.
You would think that that would be kind of self-explanatory when things are anti-Semitic.
You think most of the world is anti-Semitic, and they are for a variety of different reasons. You've got 1.5 billion Muslims. The Quran is more anti-Semitic than Hitler's Mein Kampf. You understand some of the reasons. In Nazi Germany, there was an underlying resentment for Jews because of the prevalence primarily of Christianity. Christianity, because of Paul, has been anti-Semitic since its beginning, and Hitler capitalized on that. And so there are many reasons that cause people to be anti-Semitic, and there's a lot of people that play off of it to make the Jews boogeymen, but for the most part, it's pretty obvious who is and why they are. But anyway, Manfred is Gerstenfeld, earned a PhD on the subject. Now, he wrote for the largest of the Dutch media providers that there are currently more people that have neo-Nazi views, and to use his jargon, in the Netherlands than the number of Dutch collaborators with the Nazis during the Second World War. Now, Gerstenfeld wrote, at least 5 million Dutch have a satanic view of Israel. Now, that's kind of interesting because most Israelis don't speak of Satan. I mean, they know there's a Hasatan presented in the Torah, Prophets, and Psalms, but there isn't much discussion of Hasatan in the rabbinical arguments, the Talmud, and in Kabbalah, which permeates much of Jewish religious thought. Satan is a co-equal with God. It's a Kabbalah is an inverted view of the world, where it's kind of as Satan would have wanted it to be. Anyway, he says that at least 5 million Dutch have a satanic view of Israel. This can be concluded from a study undertaken by the University of Bielefeld for the German Social Democratic Frederick Ebert Foundation in 2011. This study has been completely ignored in the Netherlands. Quote, the study's authors asked people if they believe that Israel is conducting experimentation in the extermination against Palestinian Arabs. So the question is, do you believe that Israel is conducting a extermination war against Palestinian Arabs. 40% of the Dutch poll said yes. Now, you might say, oh, well, that means that 60% of the Dutch know that Israel's primary goal as a country isn't to exterminate a mythical people. You know, that's kind of like saying, boy, we should be really proud of mankind because 60% of Americans know that World War II was an actual event and not a dramatic theater production produced by the Disney company. 39% to 40% of Dutch citizens said that Israel was seeking to exterminate Palestinian Arabs. They were unaware of the fact that these mythical people known as the Palestinians, let's just call them Muslims, that were living in Israel before Yasser Arafat of the PLO, Muslim Brotherhood and Fatah, ordered them to rise up the Intifada against Israel, that those Muslims were the richest, freest, healthiest, and best educated Muslims in the world. And then after Yasser Arafat said, no, don't take advantage of how kind these people, how generous these people are to you, how much of a godsend it is to have them return and elevate our status, kill them. And yet, the killers are now viewed as the victims. It's astonishing how errant people's views can be. We have Larry on the line as we continue this review of this study that was done. Larry, I'd love to have your insights as we review what seems to me to be beyond comprehension in how stupid people can be.
Well, it's beyond the pale of belief. It's, you know, it's like your wife gets raped and you worry about the rapist. It's the weirdest.
Yes,
of all twists.
It is. And to think that people are this ignorant, this irrational. Yeah, if you know this little and you can and you're incapable of logical thought, then there is no way to reach these people. But you've got here at least 40% of the population of one of the most progressive and prosperous of European countries that are beyond the pale of hope. There is no amount of evidence or reason that is going to prevail with someone that stupid.
It's kind of interesting, though, because at the close of World War II or during World War II, the one group that really wouldn't turn in their Jewish community and worked with the Jewish community to really try to spare them was the Dutch.
Yeah.
I don't get what happened here.
This is kind of interesting. This is another quote. He said, already in 2003, in a Eurobarometer study, it was asked which countries are dangers to the world and to peace. Israel came in second after Iran. This was the opinion held by 59% of Europeans. And in the Netherlands, the percentage that thought that Israel, second only to Iran, was the greatest threat to world peace came in at 74%. Now, mind you, 99.9% of terrorist acts are perpetrated by Muslims. 99.9%. Israel has never sanctioned a terrorist act. And yet, these people, Europeans by 60%, the Dutch by 74%, say that Israel is the second greatest threat to peace. If you look at the Middle East, there's only one peaceful country in the middle of it. In the midst of the whole Middle East, there's only one peaceful country. Every other country wants to destroy Israel, prefer to destroy Europe and the United States along with her. And yet those countries that want to destroy Europe and America are looked at being peaceful. And the country that is most willing to side with and agree with and and be rational with Europe and America is considered the threat.
I think there's a design to that. You know, this is my personal opinion. You know, there was, prior to World War II, the Jesuits actually, did a whole lot of dirty work and blamed it on the Jews. I mean, Charles Coughlin, radio Jesuit priest, used this tactic in the 30s. And by the time World War II rolled around, you know, everything in Europe was blamed on the Jews.
Now, a lot of that is a legacy of Roman Catholicism. There's no question about that. The Jesuits are a part of Roman Catholicism, and that for all of its 1,500 year history of dominance, it perpetrated the myth that Jews were evil. They are the people that had to be hunted down and killed, and if there was a problem in the world, you could blame it on the Jews. It's the opposite position, of course, that Yahweh takes in his Torah. In fact,
what's amazing to me is that you take an organization that, you know, raped and pillaged the world for 1,400 years, like the RCC,
right,
whether through inquisitions or wars or what have you, and became the wealthiest institution of any kind in the world, and I think it's a pretty well-known fact. And yet, they blame everything on a group of people that had everything taken away from them a mere 60 years ago, that represent less than 0.2% of the world's population. And there are people who believe it.
Yeah, they must be. They must be obviously super achievers if this 0.2% of the world's population can control the rest. Or by the counter view, there's something seriously wrong with 99.8% of the world's population if they are manipulated by 0.2% when that 0.2% has essentially no means to assert its influence any more than about 200 to 300 miles from its border.
Right, but there's people, there are movements all over the place that believe this.
Yeah.
It's unreal to me. I mean, you talk about losing rational thought.
Yeah, Gerstenfeld added, with such a diabolical opinion of the Jewish state, millions of Dutchmen are thus back in the Middle Ages mentally. In other words, back in the time that you described where Roman Catholicism was the rule. Today, there are more Dutchmen in this insane viewpoint than the number of Nazis in the Netherlands during the Second World War. We'll return to Shattering Myths and to a question from Will from Iowa after the commercial break. Good morning and welcome back to Shattering Myths. We have Will on the line now and also with Larry. Will has a question about the festivals, or a statement that he'd like to make about the festivals. Good morning, Will. Welcome to the program.
Well, good morning, Yada. Good morning, Larry. I hope you all had a wonderful Passover last night.
Good morning.
We did, yes. One of my favorite days of the year.
Yeah, I was looking forward to it. But unfortunately, you know, my path is getting so narrow. Actually, we celebrated just me and my wife and our handicapped daughter, and that was it at home. Just ate.
Wow, that's the same boat I'm in, Will.
And yet, we were actually celebrating it with all of Yah's covenant family. Don't know how many members total there are in the covenant family, but there's some extraordinary individuals that are part of it, so we weren't actually alone at all.
Okay, well, my question is that, you know, it's getting past all the Judaism stuff, you know, my church. Okay, and my problem, and I've been told this by my professors when I was in college, is they go, "You're a perfectionist." I go, "Oh, yeah, I guess, you know." So they say I think too much into things. So my question is, I mean, you know, Passover, are you supposed to stay inside, or, you know, I mean, to me, what I'm understanding about Yahweh is that he is just a father. He's not a stickler on procedures. Just remember these days, what they mean, and you have understanding of what he did for us, and that's what he wants from us.
Well, you're certainly you're certainly talking to someone of like mind here, Will. And I'm going to preface this by saying something I've said a number of times before.
Yeah.
If you know, there's always a spectrum of thought, and on the spectrum of thought, I put myself in this thing that we're going to this subject that we're honing in on right now, which is how much of Yahweh's instructions are there to elicit an action of something that we do in terms of compliance with the instruction, and how much of the instruction is there so that we come to know who Yahweh is, what he is offering, and how we can capitalize on his gift. And so I'm going to put understanding at the far right, and I'm going to put methodically doing on the far left. On that spectrum, Dode, who I think is the foremost scholar on this subject, that would be David. He wrote the 119th Psalm, which is the most comprehensive, the most brilliant piece, I think, ever comprised on how to observe the Torah. His view is identical to my own. And I came to my own independent of Dode. It was nice to see that it was reinforced there. But mine is at the far right. I am one who, it sounds like you, Will, and it sounds like, my guess is it's probably also very similar to Larry, which is that I view that the vast preponderance of the teaching, guidance, and instruction that is in the Torah is there so that we might come to know who Yahweh is and what he is offering, and so that based upon understanding it, we might respond and capitalize upon it. And that all of the details are there to help us understand. So I am complete in agreement with you. I think he is our Heavenly Father. He has provided guidance, and that we are best served when we understand who he is and what he is offering and respond appropriately than we are by methodically doing something. Now, as it relates to the staying inside on Passover, Passover is an interesting day as it relates to the seven Moed Mikre. It is absolutely one of the seven Moed Mikre, but in his presentation of Pesach in the book of Kara, where he goes through and delineates everything that we need to know about his Mikre and presents them and times them and that sort of thing, he says nothing about Passover other than it's the 14th day of the first month. And so the only way you can know anything about Passover is you have to go back in time and look at how the first Passover was celebrated. Now, it's true that in the first Passover, it was celebrated by the Yehudim doing some things, the children of Israel, doing some things that were absolutely germane to their circumstance that I think does a great deal to educate us, but isn't germane to our circumstance. And let me explain some of the things that I mean. They first were asked to take the blood of the Passover lamb and smear it on the uprights and the lintel of the doorway.
Since Yahweh already did this, we don't
right.
have to do this.
And this was, but beyond even that, that was the sign for to say that we are embracing Yahweh's instructions. We understand his instructions. We understand the significance of the Passover lamb. And we're on our house, on this home, because this is all about family, we're showing our understanding. It's kind of like circumcision in that regard. And we'll be back to Shattering Myths in just a moment. Great topic, Will. Welcome back to Shattering Myths. I'm your host, Yada. We have Larry from Florida and Will from Iowa on the phone. And Will brought up something that is not just germane to the seven Moed Mikre, these invitations where we are invited to be called out and to meet with God, but I think germane to the totality of Yahweh's Torah, prophets, and Psalms. And so I'd like to spend a little more time talking about a couple of the issues that you raised, Will, and then get your feedback on them, as well as yours, Larry. The first is that there are a couple of things that affect several things that I don't do that I still appreciate and I still benefit from in terms of learning. For example, I do not bring the Passover lamb as a live animal into my home 4 days before Passover. But I understand the symbolism of that, which is that we really need to know the individual that made this ultimate sacrifice on our behalf so that we might live, and that therefore focusing on the work that Yahweh as Yahusha did on our behalf prior to Passover is a very good idea. Second, I don't smear the blood of the lamb that I prepare for Passover on my doorway. But I certainly understand the symbolism of that, which is that Passover is the doorway to life because the lives of the children inside of those homes were spared. And so I understand the correlation between the sacrifice of the Passover lamb and the and life, and also its identification as the doorway, as the first threshold that we walk through in our walk to God. Another example would be that that night, because of the death and destruction that occurred that night in the most religious and political militarized place on earth, that the children of Israel were told to stay inside and keep a watch with their families. And I understand that the covenant is all about family, and that once we are inside of God's home, we never leave God's home. That it is a place of permanent and eternal protection and joy and comfort for us, a place that we will live forever. So I understand the symbolism of that. I'm grateful for the symbolism of it. I celebrate the symbolism of it, but it's not something that I view that doing is particularly helpful. Now, that's not to say that I don't do some of the things that are specifically prescribed. I grill lamb. I dip matzah, unleavened bread, into oil with bitter herbs, because I understand the symbolism of all of those things too. Why the lamb was chosen, who the lamb is, and what the oil and herbs represent.
Now, well, that's really good. I feel a little bit better about your analogy on this, and I have the same understanding, but. One thing we did not do is we did not do lamb, because I have an individual here who does not like lamb, but we did chicken enchiladas, and our unleavened bread was homemade tortillas.
You can use homemade tortillas. The issue with most store-bought tortillas is they have leaven in them. Now, going on to a little bit more in terms of the next comment that you made, which is that now you're dealing with we don't have to do it because Yahusha did it. We have to be really careful there. Once again, God has invited us to attend this celebration of life with Him, just as He has asked us to attend and has many special insights relative to the celebration of matzah, which was extraordinarily painful for Him, but wonderful for us, and He's asked us to observe this as well. Yes, Yahusha did both of these things, but that does not change God's invitations for us to participate in them. It's just that like the detail of what occurred in Mitzrayim, the crucible of Egypt, we ought to look at what Yahusha did and tie it to the explanation and the purpose of these days so we better understand them. For example, Yahusha, as the sacrificial lamb on Mount Moriah, was nailed to an upright pole. We ought not try to celebrate Pesach by crucifying ourselves. But we can look at the act on the upright pole on Mount Moriah, the same place where Abraham brought Yishak, and Yahweh spared Yishak and confirmed the covenant with Abraham by providing his own lamb there at that same place. We can look at the symbolism of that and pull the whole picture together and understand the connection with the covenant. And so just as Yahusha had his soul pay our debt to perfect us by going into Sheol on matzah, I'm going to tell you, I'm not going to celebrate matzah by asking God to send my soul over to Sheol. So, but I can certainly learn a lot by the fact that he was willing to do this. And I'm celebrating the fact that God himself did this for Will, for Larry, and for myself.
Yeah, we're just really thanking him that he went through that for us in our stead.
Yeah, he provided the means for us to go from our world to his home. This is the path. He prepared he conceived this path, he announced this path, and he promised that this path would prevail, and then he did all of the work necessary to enable this path on our behalf. And as it relates to this path, all we have to do is respond to his invitations, to meet with him at this time, to celebrate what he has done, to come to know it, understand it, and respond to it. It's just as this relationship, this covenant relationship that we have with God requires us to do certain things. We have to participate for it to be valid.
But our rest part of this, these celebrations, what I'm reading, is that we're not supposed to do his word by going out
that's
and bringing
correct. Correct.
About him. We
correct.
This.
Correct.
Discuss it between ourselves.
Yeah. Salvation is a byproduct of the covenant relationship. Salvation is our Heavenly Father for his covenant children, saving them.
That's the thing of Judaism I can never get. Like, I have one group that says, well, I belong with some people I associate with. It's one guy's telling me that they won't even flip on a light switch. Well, that's kind of dumb in my book. I mean, effort to get out of the bed than it does to turn the light
switch. You know, Judaism, which is an argument against God, just as Pauline doctrine is an argument against God, seeks to create a set of rules to control people.
Yep.
And therefore there are two connotations with Shabbat. One connotation of Shabbat is that it is a promise. It is a sworn oath. Actually, there's three connotations of Shabbat. That's one. The second is that it represents the number seven. And the third is that it speaks of rest and being settled. And so they extrapolate all of the errant concepts associated with rest and being settled as doing nothing. The Sabbath was not made for doing nothing. It is God's promise to take himself plus ourselves and bring us together for all eternity, and that he says that he will settle us in his home and settle our debt if we rely on him to do so. That's the meaning of the Shabbat and the meaning of the seventh day. And religious Jews will turn that into let's do nothing. Let's create a bunch of laws that say we can do nothing on this day. That's not its intent.
Because on some Shabbats, I want to, you know, read and recite his word. Because from my understanding, he invites us, and then we in turn invite him into our lives, too. And we're meeting together.
Correct. Well, you just look at what Yosha did on the Shabbat. It says, as was his custom, he went into the synagogues on the Shabbat to read and to recite the Torah, prophets, and Psalms. And what else did he do on the Shabbat? He healed.
He healed, yeah.
And there is no time where he has done more magnificent work on the Shabbat than on the Shabbat of Matzah. Matzah, which is the first day, is a special Sabbath because God is perfect. He orchestrated the year 4000 Yah such that when he himself did the work necessary on this special Shabbat to perfect us, it was done on a natural Shabbat as well. It was a natural Sabbath in 4000 Yah, which is 33 CE.
You know, there's another aspect of this, too, is where people take the word observe, and they turn it into obedient. You know, it's like calling Yahweh Lord. You know, it's a changing of his character. If people people came to understand the true nature of Yahweh, they would understand he's not out threatening people all the time, right, commanding them and making them be obedient like a dog. You know, we do what we understand to do, but again, I'm in agreement. It's far more about understanding and showing up.
Right. You know, Will and Larry, it is true that Shamar is corrupted in most English translations. It's actually changed to keep. It is Shema, which means to listen, that is changed to obey. Now, there is no connotation whatsoever of obey with the verb to listen, just as there is no connotation of to keep in the sense of doing something and not varying from it in the concept of Shamar, to observe. So to observe is to use your eyes to read and recite a written document, and a Shema, which is to listen, is to listen to what those words have to tell us. And this perspective is really the ultimate umbrella over this whole perspective, just as Larry has mentioned. If you view the Torah as rabbinic Jews do, and as the Pauline doctrine demands, as a set of laws which must be obeyed, that are harsh laws that can't possibly be obeyed, and therefore condemn, then you will hate it, and you will hate its author. But if you view the Torah as Yahweh himself describes it, as guidance, as teaching, as instruction from our Heavenly Father to his covenant children, to instruct us as to how we can participate in this relationship, and how God saves his children, and we understand that the meaning of Shamar is to observe this, and Shema is to listen to his advice, then everything makes sense, and all the pieces fit together, and we have the opportunity to become God's children, immortal and perfect. I am Yada. This is Shattering Myths. Back in a moment. Shattering Myths. We're here with Larry and with Will. It's kind of interesting, guys, that as I sat down in the chair this morning about 30 or 40 minutes before showtime and was preparing the notes for today's program, I had gone through the news and done a review of it and edited the news, and my computer shut down and I lost all the work that I had done. And just moments before showtime, I'm saying, okay, now I need to redo all my work. And I said, you know, I really don't want to do this anyway, because wouldn't today, since it is Passover, we celebrated Passover last night, yes, but the scriptural day begins at sundown and ends at sunset, so today is also Passover. Wouldn't it just be better to spend the entire discussion on these first three Moed Mikre, these opportunities to meet with God? And turns out that we have done mostly that. So sometimes it's better not to be prepared and to see where a program leads than it is to try to prepare. And
could I ask Will something? Are you still on the line, Will? You ever hear of I Owe the World an Apology?
No, I mean, I think I've heard, you know, statement like that, but I've never.
That would be Iowa, Will.
Iowa?
That's,
oh, okay.
Yeah, I'm from there. I can do that. Where are you at? Originally, yeah, many years ago. Where are you at in Iowa?
Hazleton, little bitty town, east of Waterloo.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, I was originally from a town called Keokuk.
That's
the southeast corner.
Yeah, every time that I go through Iowa now, it's to put fuel in an airplane that can't make it across country without a fuel stop. And each time that I land there, I'm amazed by the fact that there isn't a tree in sight, that it is flat as a pancake, that much of the towns look like they were shuttered about 20 years ago, that life is really genteel and that people are extraordinarily nice, but the wind never stops blowing.
Well, what's happened there is it's really went to a high taxation type situation, and the town I grew up in was 15,000, a little more. When I grew up, it's now less than 3.
Yeah,
so
it looks like the most
state.
Yeah, most of the towns that I have been into look like the airports and the towns look like they had once been vibrant. They are no more. That the people are still lovely and nice, but that as a whole. That which had once been vibrant is no longer.
Yeah, it went from the country went from a farming economy to an urban economy, and that was it. Yeah.
Transitions. Well, returning to God's presentation here. If there is a singular thing that would be the most beneficial for our listeners, whether it be participation in the covenant, whether it be answering Yah's invitations to show up at his festival feasts, particularly now that we're celebrating the first 3, Passover, unleavened bread, and first fruits, whether it be examining what he etched in stone, whether it be opening the book of Bereshith, the first book of Genesis, called Genesis the first book of the Torah, and reading his creation account, and then his story about the flood, about Noah, the story of the Garden of Eden and what it all represents, and then moving on to the establishment of the covenant with Abraham, and then even going further and considering God coming for his children and bringing them home and providing a historic context for the first 4 Moed Mikrei, for each of these in a place in history. And then moving into his summation of these days and the importance of the Yobel years as we move into the book of Korah. That if you keep in mind this perspective, that God wants nothing more nor nothing less than to be our Heavenly Father. That he communicates with and through men just like you and me. And that his goal is for us to come to know him so that we choose to be adopted into his family. And then he saves those. He empowers and enriches, enlivens, and helps grow those who make that choice. And if you look at everything he says, right down to the, you know, eating shellfish isn't healthy. Eating swine is not good for you, but eating these things is quite good for you. If you look at every bit of it as insights from a dad who cares and loves us, that will help us live longer, healthier, and more complete and joyous lives, then you're almost home.
Hi, I'm Dr. Joel Wallach, the Dead Doctors Don't Lie guy. There's no reason why you shouldn't live to be at least 100 and have a great time getting there. And I'm going to give you a free copy of